Tax Update for Saturday, November the 11th, 2006. This is Tax Update for Saturday, November the 11th, 2006. This week we look at Section 83B election and their consequences. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected through their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and the supporting documents may be reproduced freely as long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the podcast. Such a prohibited use would include using the podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Limeburg Information Services, located on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. Limeburg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe their services. Again, you can visit them on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. Well, this week we have a tax court case that came down, the tax case of Cadillac versus Commissioner, 127 TC number 13, that deals with the issue of Section 83B elections, particularly 83B elections as they relate to the alternative minimum tax. And this week we're going to look at the issue of a taxpayer who decided after the fact that maybe they didn't like the results of the 83B election and attempted to get it undone by claiming it was invalid to begin with. As may not be terribly surprising, the tax court wasn't terribly receptive to this theory, and the taxpayer lost. But nevertheless, it's an interesting case to consider the issues of what you're risking when you make an 83B election, as well as why you'd make one, and to look at the reasoning the tax court used for why the taxpayer was stuck with their 83B election once it was made. Now, Section 83 deals with the question of property given as compensation, and specifically we're going to deal with the issue of property that's given as compensation to a service provider that comes with certain strings attached. Restrictions, let's say forfeitures. Somewhat of a normal structure quite often. You see employees are granted the rights to certain things. Let's say we will give our employees stock and we'll grant them stock in the corporation. But if they leave us before 5 years are up, then the corporation has the right to redeem that stock either at a very, very low price, or the stock is simply forfeited. In essence, the employee gets it, but it's conditioned only upon the employee remaining in the position for the full 5 years. As well, it may be that we give them this property, but we vest it slowly. So over time, they earn their way into parts of these shares. So I grant the employee 100 shares of stock, and over the next 5 years, every year they vest in 20% or get 20% of those shares made available to them. Now, they may have full ownership officially during the period that they hold those shares unvested, in the sense that they would get all dividends, they would have all voting rights, and everything else that goes with the stock, except, of course, they cannot transfer it, and they do not, and they may have to give it back to me as the employer should they leave employment. In fact, they may have to give it back to me should they leave employment, even if it's because I'm the one that terminates their employment. Now, the basic rule we find in Section 83A tells us that employees become taxable on property at the earlier of the date the property becomes transferable, so I can sell it, or it's no longer subject to a substantial risk of forfeiture. And the amount that is taxable is the difference between the value of the property at the date that we get our right to transfer it, or the right is no longer forfeitable, and the amount the employee paid, if anything, to acquire the property. Now, of course, the timing may prove to be a problem in that case if the asset is appreciating. Again, let's take our example where I gave an employee 100 shares of stock. Well, I may have given the employee 100 shares of stock today, the stock selling at $1 a share. 5 years from now, so that means if the employee was taxed immediately today on the value, because as we know under Section 83, income is basically all income from all sources, and that would include property. So normal rules, if we didn't have Section 83, if I give an employee 100 shares of stock today in the company, it's worth $1 a share, the employee would pick up $100 worth of income. Now, let's go on to the next step, though. Under Section 83A, we're told, well, if there are substantial restrictions, basically we have a substantial risk of forfeiture, we're going to hold back and not include that, but we're not going to value it at today's price. 5 years from now, the stock is selling for $10 a share. At that point, the restrictions lapse and the employee has no substantial risk of forfeiture. At that point, the employee now will include $1,000 in their income rather than $100. Well, the employee may not be terribly thrilled with that because, of course, one of the reasons why we're giving stock-based compensation and one of the reasons why our employee might be very happy to receive stock-based compensation is because they believe the value of the company is going to increase. If it's going to be an incentive to keep employees there, generally it'll be an incentive because the theory is this is a good thing to hold and it is valuable consideration and valuable in the sense it will continue to grow and be a good investment. That makes it more valuable. When we consider the dot-com boom and all the things that happened in Silicon Valley and all the issues during that period of time, obviously that was the reason why stock options were so valuable. Those of you who had clients in that period and knew stock rights or stock options were considered very valuable consideration, it was largely because of the theory that, of course, they went up in value so rapidly that even though the option may have been granted and normally would be granted to buy the stock at the fair market value price on the date of grant, instead, the employee's theory was, you know, the theory of the option was that it would continue to grow in price so that by the time the employee actually exercised it, the difference would be a much smaller differential in the price, or it would be a much larger differential. So even though I was granted the option, and in Silicon Valley cases, quite often the issue became you may have been granted the option to buy stock at $1 a share. By the time you totally vested in those options and maybe exercised the option, the stock might have been selling for $100 a share. One other key issue. In most cases with options, and this is important to understand in the Cadillac case, even if you weren't vested in the option, you still could exercise it virtually immediately. But if you exercised it, what you got was restricted stock, meaning if you left employment before the period occurred where you vested in, where those options would have vested, you, in essence, had to basically forfeit the shares back to the employer. Quite often forfeit them back to the employer, and the employer would buy them back for simply the strike price they'd originally given you. In the case of Mr. Cadillac, that's what we'll be looking at, is a case like that. Now, we still have the issue about this huge appreciation. You know, the stock's going up in value. By the time it's non-forfeitable, it's going to be a lot bigger number in income than it was if I'd been able to include it when I initially got it, when maybe there was little or no extra value in my, would have been included in my income. True, very true. In the Cadillac case, we're going to find this is an extreme differential where the difference between the price, the value at the date it was granted to him, which was a strike price on options, was $3,600. The value of the options at the date he actually finally exercised and still made his 83B election at that point was going to be over $3 million. And he made that election, obviously, because he believed it would go up even more. So we could have various cases where if we could somehow include the income today, saying, okay, I want to ignore this problem, and I don't care that I might forfeit it. I just want to pick it up in income today so that I don't get nailed in the future for all the appreciation I expect to happen. Well, Congress decided that that was okay, but just as there are strings attached to the stock or to the property that the employee is given, in this case, Congress said, if you're going to make this election, we're going to put some important strings on this election as well. The strings in question both control how quickly you must make up your mind to do the election, as well as the consequences should you later find out that it wasn't a smart thing to do. Well, let's go through the mechanics of the 83B election. Not surprisingly, the place you start to look for the 83B election is Internal Revenue Code Section 83B. And that provides that, in general, a person who performs services in connection with which property is transferred to any person may elect to include in his gross income for the taxable year in which such property is transferred the excess of the fair market value of such property at the time of transfer, determined without regard to any restriction other than a restriction which, by its terms, will never lapse, over the amount paid for such property. If the election is made, this section shall not apply with respect to the transfer of such subsection A, which is the one that says we hold off, we include the income when you finally get it, make it become no longer subject to a risk of forfeiture, does no longer apply. So we don't include that increase in the future. And if such property is subsequently forfeited, no deduction shall be allowed in respect of such forfeiture. Well, that's the second caveat we'll talk about here. Now, the election itself under Section B2 is required to be made within 30 days after the transfer of the property, and the election may not be revoked per the code without the consent of the IRS. Now, to make the election, as noted, you must make it within 30 days after the date of transfer. And the regulation you need to look at, if you're making an 83B election, the regulation you should always have in front of you whenever somebody is using or making an 83B election, or you're considering one, is Regulation 1.83-2. Now, the statement, the content of the statement is found at 1.83-2E. And the statement essentially contains the name, address, and taxpayer ID number of the taxpayer, a description of the property to which with respect you're making the election, the dates on which the property is transferred and taxable year for which the election is made, and the nature of the restriction or restrictions to which the property is subject, the fair value at the time of the transfer determined without regard to any lapse restrictions as defined in 1.83-3I of each property with which respect the election is being made, the amount you paid for such property, and with respect to an election made after July 21, 1978, which of course means every election, a statement to the effect that copies have been furnished to other persons as provided in paragraph D of this section. Now, you've got to send one copy of the election to the IRS service center at which the taxpayer files his or her return. As well, you have to attach one copy to the tax return for the taxpayer in the year in question. And you must also give one copy of the election to the service recipient. Okay, that's the person you must give it to under 1.83D2. So basically, when you make this election, you make the election, and there are three copies that must be generated. One that goes directly to the IRS within the 30-day period. One that goes to the service provider, again within the 30-day period. The service, I should say, recipient within the 30-day period. And the one that goes with the tax return. Those three documents are found. Now, obviously, I will note it is important to document the time frame. So this is one of those cases, again, where it would be very, very useful to have proof of mailing, meaning certified mailing and all those other nice little details, so that it's not later questioned whether the taxpayer has made that election. But the election is made within that 30-day period. Now, as we noted in 83B1's final clause, there's a major gotcha here. If you do end up forfeiting the property, you will get no deduction allowed for the forfeiture. What that means is, if I had made that election, I was given 100 shares of stock, I elected to basically make the 83B election, I'm taxed today at $100 on those shares. If I don't stay the 5 years and I forfeit those shares back to my employer, I do not get a deduction for a $100 loss on disposition of the shares. Rather, I get no deduction. And nothing happens. I have simply included $100 in my income, which effectively I never got the benefit of. It has just simply been included in my income. That's the trade-off of making the 83B election. Congress has told us the general rule is you wait till the end and you wait till you know you have it. Once you know you have it, we'll tax it. If you want to say, well, don't do that because I expect it's going to go up in value, Congress has said, fine, but we have a bargain here. When you make that election and when you decide we want to be taxed on it today, if it turns out down the line that that was a dumb move, we blocked you in two ways. If it was a dumb move because maybe the property didn't appreciate and in fact went down in value, you must have the permission of the IRS to undo the election. Now, when you check the regulation, Regulation 1.832F makes it clear the IRS will only grant a reversal of this election if there was a mistake of fact, and then you have a very limited time frame after discovery of the mistake of fact to request the election be undone. So Congress has said, essentially, we're essentially blocked out. Once we make the election, we're committed, even if it turns out that was a dumb move. So that means if the value of our stock were to go from $100 to $1, even though I continued to work there and didn't forfeit it, I'm going to be stuck with having to sell it and having a $100 capital loss. But even worse, if I just don't meet the conditions, I don't stay there 5 years, or I'm terminated before 5 years is up, and I forfeit the share under those provisions of the agreement, then I have no deduction whatsoever. Congress is saying you cannot second guess. We seriously do not want this provision in the law second guessed, because obviously, if you were allowed to second guess it, what taxpayers would do is generally make the 83B election without even thinking about the problem, and then if it turned out wrong, undo the election or try to get it undone. Now, it should also be clear there's going to be quite a few circumstances where things don't work out the way the taxpayers had expected, and because of that, taxpayers will want to undo their 83B election. We saw that quite a bit in the dot-com era. The issue became there very simple, and unfortunately, irrational. Our clients and taxpayers took a look, saw shares increasing. Remember, that was a period when it appeared that stocks could do nothing but go up at 30% or more per year. And if they were tech stocks, they would go up by 10 or 15 times a year. In that environment, the whole question about the risk of making an 83B election and perhaps being stuck with the stock's value as being worth far less than you had elected in at, or the risk of being terminated from your employment involuntarily because the company was laying people off or you left, those just seem like no big deal. I wouldn't do that because the stock's going up so rapidly. I'm going to invest and they're going to keep me. And clients tended to dismiss the risk of the 83B, and they read all the articles about how what any idiot obviously should be doing is making the 83B election to lock in that lower tax value. So many of them did it. Now, in the case of many of them that had options, the issue was you would exercise the option, and you would make the 83B election to include the spread in income immediately. Or if they were ISO options, and this is the case in Mr. Cadillac's case, you would make the election to include the spread for AMT purposes. You make an 83B election. And the theory was that was such a smart move because 5 years down the line, when those items finally vested, the stock obviously was going to be worth far more. And you really didn't want to pay that income tax because we know that's really, really a problem, that we hated paying those income taxes. And, you know, it was just going to be a horrendous number at the back end. It did not really bother taxpayers that if they waited till the back end, at least though we knew they had sufficient wealth at that point in time, once invested, if we sold the shares immediately, that there was at least sufficient wealth available to offset the taxes. And we actually had shares. There wasn't the risk that we'd have nothing at the back end. But in an irrational period, taxpayers tend to get more off on the fact that they just worry about the tax side. And everybody discounted the consequence of having the price of their stock drop, at least at that point. Now, obviously, as circumstances worked out for the beginning part of this decade, a number of taxpayers discovered their 83B election wasn't such a smart idea. Now we enter the case of Mr. Cadillac. Now, Mr. Cadillac was granted incentive stock options by his employer, Ariba Technologies, Inc. As mentioned before, ISOs, when you exercise them, do not create taxable income for the employees for regular tax purposes, so it wasn't really an issue for 83B on that election. That was irrelevant. There'd be no inclusion. But since he was exercising these options before they became vested, he was concerned about the fact that for AMT purposes, you do have to basically tax the option under Section 83 standard rules. That means that we would include, when he finally vested, the spread between the strike price, which is the price Mr. Cadillac had paid for his shares, and the fair market value on the date they became non-forfeitable, in his income for AMT purposes, meaning he would probably have a substantial AMT tax. Now, Anthony Cadillac exercised his options at a time when he would not be fully vested in the shares. That means if he left any time before he was fully vested, he would lose some of the shares. What happened was, in his case, Ariba had had basically a right to call the shares, or, you know, call the shares back in and pay him only his strike price. So if he left early, for whatever reason, including involuntarily, Ariba could pull back the strike price. Now, the Ariba Technology shares, Mr. Cadillac was looking at the fact that they had greatly appreciated during the period from the time his option was granted in 1998 until he exercised them in April 2000. Parenthetically, those of us who ran through that period know that was probably about the worst possible moment if you're in a tech company to actually pull the trigger, because that was virtually at the peak. But Mr. Cadillac did that. In April 2000, he pulled the trigger. Those options would not fully vest until February of 2002. Now, the difference had occurred already for Mr. Ariba. When he was granted the options, the shares he would have exercised, he had to pay $3,002 for those shares. At the date he finally exercised those options, which occurred basically about 2 years later, the fair market value of those same shares had now grown to over $3.2 million. Now, Mr. Cadillac, based upon that history, clearly saw, you know, the writings on the wall. These shares are going up rapidly, and I'm going to be nailed for $3.2 million in spread right now, virtually the whole $3.2 million. But, you know, if I wait, obviously I'm going to be nailed for $6-7 million in spread at the end of this period. So it's much better to go ahead and take the hit now, which is what he did. So he timely filed an election under Section 83B. triggering the future inclusion of income, including the current exclusion, I should say, of income in the of spread in the AMT income, but it protected him from future increases in the value as he vested in the shares. As I will remind you, at that time in our history and that time in how the stock market is being done, the tech industry, I know from my clients there were tons of articles telling them about the 83B election, what a wonderful deal this was. And it was not unusual to see clients at that point who were so upset about the AMT and all that information and these terrible taxes they were having to pay, in their view, that they wanted to make the 83B election, even though you would explain to them the huge downside risk of making them, especially on restricted ISO shares. As we've discussed before, there was a problem with ISO shares anyway, should their value drop, even if they're not restricted. Well, take the problems you have with unrestricted shares and now make them much, much worse when the shares are restricted. So at this point, it doesn't even matter how much they drop. We can't even get at them to do anything about them. So we can't basically easily fix our problems or have the cash to fix our problems with these shares. But ignore that. Mr. Cadillac at the time went along with what a number of people did and said, I will make my 83B election. I will take the hit for this year's spread because I know it's just going to be worth so much more in the future. Now, unfortunately for Mr. Anthony, his employment with Ariba terminated in May of 2001. And that was before a number of his shares had vested. His shares vested on a monthly basis over the period. So he had vested in many of, but not all of the shares by the time he left employment in 2001. Now, Ariba exercised its option to repurchase the shares in question for $642. Obviously far less than the proportionate amount of the $3.6 million that Mr. Ariba had included in his income, or that Mr. Cadillac included his income. Down the line, then, Mr. Anthony Cadillac sold his vested shares to an unrelated third party in 2002 and collected cash. So at least in his case, he did have some cash available. But obviously, he now had this little problem. Well, I'd made that 83B election. I have a problem now. I would much prefer to say the 83B election was invalid or somehow didn't work. You know, I'd prefer I'd never done it. Is there a way to claim I'd never done it? Well, Mr. Cadillac consulted with a tax attorney who came up with what's one obvious solution if it is correct. And that would be, well, you know, it might be okay if, in fact, your 83B election was never valid. And so if we didn't have an 83B election or we had no right to make one, then it would be okay to amend that return because that return's an error. It would be okay. The tax would be reduced for that year. And we would include the spread basically at the dates that you had previously vested in those, that when you finally got the shares being not subject to forfeiture. So we would slowly include the spread each month as you vested in shares and we just restate your returns under that provision. So Mr. Anthony had amended returns prepared that claimed the big refund back in the year of exercise in 2000 and then continued to recognize his income as the shares vested over the following years. The IRS, of course, now is saying, sorry, we don't quite agree with that. Now we take a look at this. Mr. Anthony said, why was his 83B election bad? Well, he tried a couple of options to get there. First, he claimed that under California law, he was not the owner of the shares due to the fact they're being held in escrow, so he really couldn't be held to be the owner of the shares. He didn't really own the shares at that point. And since he didn't own the shares, he couldn't make an 83B election. You know, you can only make an 83B election if you're granted property. And his theory effectively was that at this point, he had not been granted property. Well, the tax court said, we don't agree with that position. The tax court pointed out that we don't necessarily need pure legal title, so the fact that you technically may not be the owner under California code of those shares is not relevant if, in an issue that we've often hit when we talk about home mortgage interest, if you are the beneficial owner of the property. That is, you have all the rights, and you have the rights, main rights and obligations that go with the property. The court noted, essentially, that during the time period the shares were in escrow, he still had the right and received all dividends declared with regard to the shares. He had the right to vote the shares. The only thing he could not do at that point was basically sell them. They were subject to a forfeiture, subject to the ability for Ariba to pull them back if he violated the requirements of the grant, and that was that he no longer was employed there. And as I noted, he could violate that even if he wasn't the party that caused the employment to terminate. So, as noted, since he was the beneficial owner, the court said, well, this is clearly what Section 83 was meant to cover. When you think about it, if this theory worked, then you never could make a valid 83B election, since in almost no case could you argue, you could always argue I wasn't really the owner. And that would mean that nobody could make an 83B election. The real problem with his position when you try to think it through is it would seem that there would be no point in Section 83 being in the code, Section 83B being in the code, because we would never be in a position where an election could be granted. It would also be a case, A3A would make much sense, because obviously, again, you can have income, and it couldn't be included in your income until such time as you were granted the property. And of course, if we really look just at the technical ownership and the escrow account was enough to kill that, nobody could make the election. So the tax court, not surprisingly, said, we understand your theory, we looked at it, but you didn't understand that beneficial ownership was good enough. Now, Anthony next tried one other issue. You may have noticed we were discussing that we valued it, you know, the only restrictions we had to reduce it by were restrictions that by their very nature would never go away. So therefore, it was due to an event certain to occur. And Anthony said, well, you know what? No way can I be employed by Ariba forever. If nothing else, I would die someday and my employment with Ariba would terminate. Therefore, because the forfeiture would be based upon my termination of employment, and since my termination of employment will occur someday, that is an event certain to occur, and therefore, under Regulation 1.83-3A3 and 5, that event is one that, therefore, you must consider in valuing the shares. And when you consider that event, you have to value them basically back at the strike price. Well, the tax court said, we don't buy that one either. They pointed out that while the regulations did discuss a case where the taxpayer would be granted shares, let's take the fact pattern. You are my employee. I will give you 100 shares of stock. And you'll get the dividends from that stock. You have the right to vote that stock while you're employed by the company. But on the day you leave employment, you are required to give me back the 100 shares. If that is the case, it is a term, it is an item that by its very terms will never lapse, then that restriction is one you could ignore, or that restriction is one you have to pay attention to in valuing the shares. In this case, the court pointed out that the problem Mr. Cadillac had was that the real question of the condition was not whether he'd be terminated, but would he be terminated before the shares vested? Because the restriction, basically the restriction, was not an event certain to occur, because the event in question would be, would he be terminated before the shares vested? As the tax court pointed out, that was not certain to occur. In fact, as the court pointed out, he did vest in a number of shares. Therefore, he could not avail himself of this provision. Again, under the logic of this provision, under the logic of Mr. Cadillac's position, if that position was correct, again, it would seem like 83Bs would be radically changed, and that didn't seem to be the purpose Congress was after. It seemed to me that everybody was pretty clear that the intent of Congress was that you agreed to pick up the real spread today in exchange for us not hitting you for the spread on the date you became, on the date you received the shares. You finally are able to receive the shares and totally use them. They're non-forfeitable. That trade-off being given, it does not seem fair to go back and somehow now say that, well, if it's an event that is certain to occur, but the event is not certain to trigger the reduction in value, you know, you still get to make use of that. Mr. Cadillac would have, had he stayed employed, and obviously to the extent he did stay employed, and he still had, and there were shares he retained, he did get the benefit of having those shares down the line, having them unrestricted. Therefore, the tax court held, this does not work. Mr. Anthony also tried an option of claiming he was somehow going to sneak this under the claim of rights doctrine. If you take a look at the case, you'll discover the tax court wasn't thrilled with the claim of right theory either. So the tax court went down these rules and took a look at and basically came down, and in this case, which is a published case, told us that basically they really did not endorse, under the theories that were offered by Mr. Cadillac, any type of after-the-fact Section 83 planning. I'm sure the tax court theory is no question as well, just in general. Obviously, taxpayers whose 83B elections worked are not lining up to suddenly say, I had no right to make these elections. And in fact, had there been a case that had suggested Mr. Anthony's theories were correct, back in the late 90s, there would have been much howling and screaming from the tech community about how unfair that result was and how contrary it was to the law. Now, in retrospect, we want to undo it. What's our lesson as tax professionals in this area? Well, there's a couple of them. The first one, which is now very easy to deal with, and everybody will kind of agree, is it is a very good lesson in having to serve as kind of the warning light for your client. We do things, and we tell clients about issues. We do have to tell clients, and I think it's always important to let the client know, what could be the bad result if you do this particular option or you take this particular route for tax purposes when you have choices. In this case, if you make an 83B election, it is very important for the taxpayer to understand what happens if it doesn't work. It's also probably important for us to be sober and indicate to taxpayers that, you know, I know it that you don't think it's going to happen, and I'm fine, and if that's ultimately your call, then, you know, I will certainly help you because it's certainly a legitimate tax planning issue to do. It's certainly a legitimate tax position to take. There's no problem. We'll make the election. But you need to clearly understand what could go wrong. Why? Because in hindsight, clients may decide that, well, had they just known, they wouldn't have done it. That's why you need to make this clear to them. As well, as a service to your client, sometimes you've got to, you know, at least make them consider that what could go wrong. And at least be sober on the idea of, okay, I am comfortable or not comfortable. I had a number of clients where we discussed this issue in the late 90s and the early parts of this decade. And in some cases, to be honest, we did come to the conclusion where the client was leaning toward doing it. But after explaining the issues and indicating to the client, you know, the one advantage you have by not doing it is at the time when these shares become vested and you can actually sell them, you know, no matter what the tax hit is at that time, at least you will have assets to pay them. If you don't do that, and if the shares come down, or if the company goes under, then you may not have the cash to pay these shares, or you may not have the cash to pay this liability at that point, or you may be stuck with never getting the benefit. Clients need to understand that. Unfortunately, items like this tend to become hot within an industry and go forward. Secondly, as we say, the concept, as I recall at the time, we heard from Alan Greenspan, was irrational exuberance in the stock market. It is important that quite often our clients do get tied up in the tax strategy of the moment that is tied to the belief that whatever is the current hot investment will continue to be hot and go up forever. As in the late 90s, that was the stock market, and we had a lot of oddball things people were doing because they believed stocks could never go down. In more recent years, real estate's become the key, and we are now beginning to see signs in the residential housing market that, you know, the end has come, the rapid run-up will not continue. It is important to give clients perspective. We are the financial and economic professionals. We're the ones who see this and supposedly can give them some rationality in how things are working, as opposed to just gunning for whatever the current maximum tax advantage is, presuming that everything else stays constant. We have that requirement and we'll work with it. Now, this particular week, I am going to do a couple of presentations in Ohio. I am going starting on Monday. I'll be in Dublin, Ohio, just outside of Columbus, doing a presentation on advanced C-corps. And then I will do an advanced C-corporation course in Canton, Ohio, the next day. So I'll have a nice little drive the night between to go from Columbus to Canton. And then come on Thursday, I will be speaking again, as I have in the past, at the Virginia Accounting and Auditing Conference, this time at the session going on at the Founders Inn in Virginia Beach, Virginia. And I will finish that up for this week, then head into the Thanksgiving week following. So I'm getting ready to do some interesting travels and items going on. Also, a little development in our firm, and I thought I'd make the announcement here so everybody is aware of it, because we're very excited about the situation. And that is that we will be taking on, in my local accounting firm, a new partner. Annette Lynch will be joining the firm as a partner of the firm. She has worked at the firm for many years, and she will be coming on as a partner of the firm once we get all the pieces together, but we're ready to move forward on that one. So I wanted to make the mention that we're going in that direction and we'll have a brand new partner coming online. So I'm working with some of that and getting all those pieces going with various other options this week involving with the firm has caused the podcast to come up just a little bit late, but that's the reason, the explanation. And I will be on the road next week, so we'll see how well the podcast comes together for next Saturday. But hopefully we'll get all the pieces together and have something in play at least by late Saturday, if nothing else. Now, this has been the Tax Update Podcast for Saturday, November the 11th, 2006. The Tax Update Podcast, as always, is brought to you by Limeburg Information Services, located on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. Go ahead and visit them and take a look at subscribing to their services for email newsletters related to tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of tax-related information. This has been the Tax Update.